The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good afternoon. I'm Michael Kane, the pastor at Old First Reformed United Church of Christ at 4th and Race, and I have the distinct pleasure today of introducing you to the Bishop, Gene Robinson. In the ongoing history of human liberation, as more and different people are recognized, included, and valued for their humanity in all its varied forms, there are certain individuals who go first. Since Eugene is a churchman, let's use as an example a congregation's first woman pastor, or the first time the pastor is ethnically or racially different than most of the people in the pews. Obviously, in North America and around the world these days, we often hear of the first gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people publicly acknowledged in certain roles and leadership positions. Today, we have the honor of hearing from the first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion. The first often have quite a struggle to get where they are, to get recognized and respected. And often, as in Gene's case, the struggle didn't end there with election or consecration or faithful service. But the firsts, when they wear their mantles well, they make the world a better place for all of us. What the Bible calls living abundantly. The Right Reverend Gene Robinson has worn the mantle of his office well. He's become a compassionate, generous, and humane advocate for the rights and equality of queer folk. He's also maintained an openness and love for those who would deny him and others their place at the table. It's important that as the world struggles to affirm LGBT folk, the church participates with the world, shares in and even shares its struggle. Those of us far from the debates in the Anglican Communion are thankful for Gene's witness and transformative ministry, and that ministry has never just become one topic. He's also been a fierce advocate for women's right to choose and the plight of poor people. Gene is much more than the gay bishop, even if we're thankful that he is that. Gene's parents were tenant tobacco farmers in Kentucky. He was raised in the Christian Church Disciples of Christ. He attended the University of the South, majoring in American Studies. In high school and college, he says, the Episcopal Church got a hold of him. He attended General Theological Seminary in New York City, was ordained a priest at the Episcopal Cathedral in Newark, served as a curate of Christ Church in Ridgewood, New Jersey, before moving to New Hampshire. He served as the canon to the ordinary, the assistant to the bishop, for those of us who aren't familiar with Anglican idiom, for 18 years. He's a proud father of two daughters, Jamie and Ella. He remembers his marriage to their mom as a blessing. He's now the grandfather of two. Gene came out in the mid-80s and has been in a relationship with his husband, Mark, since 1987. They were civil unioned in 2008, and legally married in 2010. Thanks be to God. Gene was elected a bishop 10 years ago this month and consecrated later that year. He retired in January of this year. Tomorrow night, the library is joining with WHYY for a free screening of Love Free or Die, a movie that offers a glimpse of his service as bishop. That'll be at 7 p.m. at 150 North 6th Street. And his ministry continues. Not just as an author and a speaker, he's now a senior fellow half-time at the Center for American Progress in D.C. But today we're blessed to have him here with us as he talks to us about his latest book. I ask you to welcome Gene Robinson.
Thank you. Wow. I'm everywhere. And I think my, yeah, this works too, because I'm a wanderer. Thank you for coming to miss your lunch hour and to be here. I'm delighted. I just did an hour with Marty Mosgoin on WHYY, which was delightful, and I got to finally sit and chat with Terry Gross, whom I've interviewed with four times and have seen, but never have gotten to sit with her. She's one of the greatest interviewers, if not the best, in the whole world. So I'm delighted to be here in Philadelphia and to talk about this book that somehow I got written despite having a day job as the Bishop of New Hampshire. It's still kind of a miracle to me. The origin of the book, I got a call from Desmond Tutu's book person. He had heard me on NPR talking about gay marriage and thought there was a book in me. And so he called Desmond and got my contact information called to propose this to me. And I said, I don't have time to write a book. But he ultimately convinced me otherwise. And then it turns out the book comes out at just the time the Supreme Court is considering this. And of course, we see unprecedented change. I mean, the kind of movement forward we have seen in terms of civil rights for LGBT people, we have come farther, faster than almost any other civil rights movement. I think the reason for that is that we are now known to so many people. Harvey Milk back in the 70s said that coming out was the most political thing you could do. He also said, because once you know us, you'll love us. Maybe not all of us, but a fairly good number of us are pretty likable. And what we have found is that when people know someone, gay or lesbian, bisexual or transgender, then they're less willing, if not unwilling, to believe all the terrible things that have been said about us because they know it's not true of their friends. So we are seeing this really remarkable move forward. And it's important to remember that we've got a long way to go. 90% of Americans believe that you can't be fired from your job for being gay. And it's not true. A majority of states have no protections whatsoever for someone being dismissed for being gay. And there is no federal legislation to that end. And so literally your boss can, see your picture in a gay pride parade and fire you the next day and you have absolutely no recourse. There's being introduced into Congress as we speak an Employment Non-Discrimination Act, so-called ENDA, that would change that, but there's going to be a very long road to hoe getting that passed, especially when it includes protections for transgender people. So we've got a long way to go, and despite all of the positive moves that we have seen around the issue of civil rights for LGBT people, the fact of the matter is we've still got kids hanging themselves on playground swing sets and jumping off bridges. And I think it's important for us to remember that while all the demographic information about people's changing attitudes is very positive, it means a majority. That majority is not evenly distributed throughout the nation. It's highly concentrated on the coasts, and you get to the middle part of the country or the south, and it's a world not terribly unlike the 50s. So we're making great progress, and there's much work to be done. So marriage equality has become such a focus, I think, for several reasons. One is this struggle for civil rights is actually about respect. Aretha Franklin actually got that right, you know, R-E-S-P-E-C-T. It really is about what kind of respect do we as individuals and our families, what kind of respect do we have? And we learned a long time ago that separate is not equal. And so this fight for the institution of marriage and the word marriage is really important, and I'll say a little bit about that in a moment. And I think it's also important to say that LGBT people of faith want God in their relationship. They want to invite God into their marriages, and therefore religious institutions are very much caught up in this. It's important to separate church and state here. What we are fighting for is the civil right to civil marriage, right? Now, in the back of people's minds, they know that marriage is a civil act, and for some people also a religious act. But the people know that it's a civil act because if their marriage falls apart and they want a divorce, they don't go back to the sweet little church where they got married. They go to the courts. But they have to be reminded all of the time because this has gotten very, very confused in Americans' minds because we deputize clergy to act as the presiding, authorizing agent in marriage. And therefore, when you go to a wedding, you don't know where the civil part begins and ends and where the religious part begins and ends. As a matter of fact, I've encouraged my clergy in New Hampshire to get out of the marriage business and to stay in the blessing business that we're actually in. And when Mark and I had our service, we acted that out. So we gathered in a church, and at the back door where the secular community and the sacred meet, our female Jewish lawyer married us. She did what the state did. And then everybody filed into the pews, and we came up the center aisle, and then we did what the church does. We listened to scripture, we had a homily, we invited God into our marriage by reaffirming our vows, we invited the community into our marriage, which is what happens actually in a wedding, and then we received the church's blessing. So everyone who attends a service like that gets an education in what's the civil part and what's the religious part. The fact of the matter is, I mean, this is a little bit frightening. The state could care less what you say or not say. You're not required to have vows, take vows, make any kind of promises. The state could care less what you say. What the state cares about are three signatures. The two people who are getting married and that of a legal authorizing agent. That's what makes you married. I suppose you could be utterly and totally silent as long as the authorizing agent has determined that you're doing this of your own free will, which is actually kind of a new thing historically. Nobody cared about your own free will if you were a woman. This was a contract between men. The one who used to control your life, your father, and the one who's going to control your life now, your husband. This is a huge thing, and it has both legal ramifications as well as emotional and spiritual ones. So it's one of those times when all the planets sort of are aligning, and this has become such a big issue. So in this book, I try to answer some of the some of the questions that people have asked me time and time and time again. And, you know, at first I thought, well, maybe people who have these questions will buy this book. Actually, I doubt that. Because if you don't really want to explore this very deeply, you're just not going to buy this book. And what I realized that that I've actually written is a script for advocates of ours. So they may be kind of quiet about their advocacy because they're afraid they're going to get asked these questions and they're not quite sure how they will answer them. And so in some sense, this book gives a script to people who want to become advocates for us and what they might say in response to some of these questions. It's also a book that's being used when a gay or lesbian couple are getting married and Aunt Tilly doesn't know quite what she thinks about coming to the wedding, is feeling a little anxious about that, and will her presence indicate her support for something that she doesn't really support? It's a great thing to send to people who are still wavering on this particular issue. And I just learned, I was at a gala dinner in Washington of OutServe, which is the organization that works with LGBT servicemen and women and veterans, and met the head honcho chaplain for the whole military. He works at the Pentagon, and he was the one who did the very first gay wedding at the West Point Chapel, and he is now using the book in his premarital counseling. He's making all of the couples read it before they proceed. So I think there are multiple uses. But let me just highlight a few of the questions that I try to deal with in the book and give you some sense of where I go with that, and then we'll open this up to questions. The very first question in the book is, why should straight people care about this? Well, there's no reason for you to, unless you care about the society in which you live. Much of what I've learned in our movement and about our movement, I learned from being a part of and studying the civil rights movement of the 1960s for African Americans. And there was a moment in that movement in which white people finally understood that we were paying a price for racism as well as black people. And so some of us joined Dr. King in the streets and joined these incredibly courageous people who were going into the streets for their civil rights, and they knew they would face snarling dogs and fire hoses and sometimes death itself, and they went anyway. And so if you care about the kind of society we live in, then you'll care about this issue. Parents ought to care in case one of their kids turns out to be gay or lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. I had an email from a guy in Texas. He said, I have three children, and I am raising them to be straight, so I have no worries about them, but blah, 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 blah. And I wrote back to him, and I said, really? I mean, really? You think you've got control over that? And what kind of a world do you want them to be living in if one of them does discover themselves to be gay or lesbian, bisexual, or transgender? So it actually matters. And having straight allies is huge. We will never be more than a small minority. And therefore, we need allies, some of whom will be invited to speak in places that we are not yet welcome. And so it's hugely important. A big question is why not civil unions? I mean, come on. If you have a status that gives you all the rights and privileges of marriage, why isn't that enough? Can you just leave us alone and let us have marriage? Well, first of all, you can find out how important that word marriage is if you suggest to heterosexually married people that let's just demote everybody to civil union status, and then let religious institutions marry people who do that sort of thing. Well, very quickly you understand that people really get that it's a demotion, and they're not willing to give up that word either. also, I mean, I think in your introduction you said we were civil unioned. I mean, we've been, you know, after we had our civil union, when that became legal in 2008, we didn't know, should we tell people we were unionized? I mean, the garment workers union probably wouldn't like it. So, well, maybe they would, actually. And a couple of examples of why it's important. If your partner is bleeding to death in the emergency room, and you arrive after you've gotten word of the accident, that is no time to teach the nursing staff what a civil union is and what it implies and what rights and privileges it offers you. You tell them that that's my husband in there, and they know exactly what that means. At the other end of the spectrum, you got a 5-year-old kid who's got two moms or two dads, and their friend asks them on the playground if their parents are married. The 5-year-old isn't going to be able to say, no, actually, it is a domestic partnership. And what that means, it ain't going to happen. But if that kid is able to say, well, of course my parents are married. Everybody knows what that means, right? And the commitment that implies, and so on. So having the word is a huge part of this. And emotionally and spiritually, for those of us who are gay and partnered, it means a lot. I have two friends, Dan and Russ. Dan Carslake was the filmmaker for the first documentary I was a part of, For the Bible Tells Me So. He and his partner have been, out. They've been together, I don't know, 25 years or something. And so they came to New Hampshire to get married, and I went with them to the town clerk's office, and they filled out all the paperwork and everything, and the town clerk hands them the marriage license and says, congratulations. And they burst into tears. They were shocked after having been in this work forever. They were shocked at the power that it had for them to have the state saying, congratulations, So this word is really important. And it's worth fighting for. In the book, I asked the question, what would Jesus do? Our evangelical conservative brothers and sisters in Christ often ask that question. And I've done this on in some interviews and everything, and, well, you can imagine the reaction. So I just simply point out that Jesus was a single man in a culture that virtually required men to be married, spent most of his time with 12 other men. He singled 3 of them out for special leadership, and one of them is known 4 times in Scripture as the one whom Jesus loved. That disciple is pictured as lying against Jesus' breast at the Last Supper, and that disciple is standing with Jesus' mother, Mary, at the foot of the cross, and from the cross, Jesus says to them, Mother, behold your son. Son, behold your mother. I'm just saying. And that's all I'm saying. We have no idea whether Jesus was ever sexually intimate with anyone. I am not saying he was gay, but I'm saying that to trot Jesus out as the poster child for the nuclear family, which is a fairly recent development anyway, a mother, a father, and 2.2 children, is just not being true to the text and what we actually do know. And we know that families of choice, which many LGBT people have had to form because they've been kicked out of their own biological families. Do you know that 40% of all the teenagers living on the streets of America are LGBT people who have been kicked out of their homes when they came out? 40%, I assure you, 40% of kids in the United States are not LGBT. There's this point in Scripture where Jesus' mother and brothers come to where Jesus is speaking at a house, and they're probably coming to get him because he's embarrassing them. I mean, he's making such a kind of a row. And he refuses to see them. And he said, who are my mother and brothers? My mother and brothers are the ones who do God's will. So Jesus knew all about families of choice. And what I am saying is that he spent his life ministering to and showing compassion for the marginalized, the dispossessed, those on the fringes of society who had been scorned, particularly by the religious community of his time. And it is hard for me to conceive that were he alive today, that he wouldn't be showing that same compassion to the LGBT community and fighting for the respect that is due every child of God. That's all I'm saying, but it's a very different message than you would get from some of my more conservative brothers and sisters. The other thing, of course, that always gets brought up, right, is aren't we changing the definition of marriage? As if we didn't change the definition of lots of words. Gay used to mean like a really fun party, you know? We change meanings of words all the time. And let's remember sort of the ways in which marriage has changed, the way marriage has developed. We often refer to polygamy in particularly the Hebrew scriptures of what Christians call the Old Testament. But actually, polygamy is not what is there. It's polygyny. Women weren't invited to have multiple husbands. Men were invited to have multiple wives. That's polygyny. So not an equal opportunity employer there, right? For men and women, it was quite common. By the time of Jesus, monogamy had become the way to go. St. Paul, believed that Jesus was coming again, the second coming, very soon, and people just needed to get ready. But he did at least, give a nod to those whose passions were so great that they just couldn't resist, and therefore he said that they should marry rather than burn. Not exactly a ringing endorsement of marriage. Let's remember that for most of the history of marriage, it was a patriarchal arrangement. I referred to this earlier. It was the transfer of property from one man to another man. We still have vestiges of that. Wedding rings actually started out as promises of the transfer of property. In some traditional weddings, you'll still see, well, in many of them, you'll see the father walking the bride down the aisle. This would be the parent who saw this child a few hours on the weekend, right? The mother sits in the front pew as if she had nothing to do with the raising of this child, right? And I put a stop to that a long time ago, and I ask both parents to walk both the husband and wife or the bride and groom down the aisle. It's much more like a sort of a prehistoric setting where two tribes get together and they offer one of their own, to make a new family. But the way this has developed and the way it's acted out in much of our language. I mean, we used to say, who gives this man, who gives this woman to be married to this man, right? Most of us now say, who presents this woman and who presents this man? But the traditional service is only giving the woman. And goodness, five more minutes. The church didn't even get involved in marriage for the longest time, not until about the 12th century, did the church get involved in it, and not until the 12th, sorry, the 12th century the church got involved, and the 13th century was the first time that a priest was required. Everybody else had a common law marriage. And the reason is that they didn't have all that much property. And marriage was all about who's going to get the goodies when the parents die. Who are the actual heirs? So if you didn't have a lot of property, nobody cared whether you were married or not. And then the church did get involved and required the presence of clergy. And during the Reformation, for the most part, marriage became a completely secular institution. The pilgrims, you know, love those pilgrims, right? It was a completely secular act. They wanted nothing to do with it. And that is very much continued in our culture until more recent times. So does gay marriage change the definition of marriage? I would argue not. And I think the analogy here is to the anti-miscegenation laws that prohibited interracial marriage. So when Barack Obama's parents were married, their marriage was illegal in 37 states. By the time it was struck down by the Supreme Court in 1967 or 8, I can't remember which, there were only 17 states that still had anti-miscegenation laws on the books. And did that change the definition of marriage just because two people of two different races could get married? No, I don't think so. It just expanded the circle of people who could avail themselves of that institution. And I would argue that the gay marriage debate is about that. In fact, sometimes it's alarming to me how conservative this movement is. Frankly, marriage could do with a little revision. But that's not what we're arguing for. That's an argument for another day. We're just arguing for the right to marry. And I would say it's more about just expanding the list of people who can avail themselves of that. Let me just finish with the sort of the conclusion of the book, which is also its title, which is that God believes in love. You know, we read in the first letter of John that where love is, that's where God is. And God is love. It seems to me that the church, the synagogue, the mosque, values marriage because it's a place to experiment, to see if any one human being can come to learn to love another human being as much as, or on a good day, even more than we love ourselves. And when that happens, it is the tiniest window into the kind of love God has for us, that kind of self-giving love. And that's why we believe it's a sacrament, some of us anyway, that it's a sacrament, that, you know, a sacrament is where God promises to show up. And so in entering into the commitment of marriage, the responsibilities of marriage, we affirm that search to find out if we could learn to love another human being as much as we love ourselves, and on a good day, maybe even more than ourselves. We know that people take little verses out of Scripture all over the place and use them for their own purposes. But surely the message of both the Hebrew Scriptures and the Christian Scriptures is that whatever God is about love. And there is no other institution that I know of beyond marriage that fosters, holds up as the ideal, that kind of selfless love. Do we fall short? Absolutely. Will we always fall short? Absolutely. But is it not worth trying? It seems to me that in marriage we see the kind of love that we would like to have for all of God's children. But if you can't do it with one person, it's hard to do it with the world. And so at the end of the day, it seems to me God believes in love, and if marriage is about love, and you have gay and lesbian couples who want to enter into that experiment in love and invite God into it, then it's worthy of our support. It's the kind of society I want to live in, and I hope it's the kind of society you want to live in. And we'll take questions. Yeah. Thank you.
Yes. on this issue, but also generically, we need to work against condemning people, gossip, saying negative things about people, judging people. It's an epidemic, and right. It's the antithesis of love. This saying negative things about people, judging them, condemning them. So let's work to talk about people in loving, kind, merciful ways.
Yeah. Was there anything that I said that you felt crossed that line?
No, I think you expressed it very well.
Okay. Good. Yeah, I mean, you know, there are very profoundly thoughtful, prayerful people who disagree on this. There are people who actually, you know, have said to me, I'd like to be able to think and feel my way to being supportive, but I just can't get past the scripture stuff. These are religious people. And we're in that funny middle time when we're just trying to figure this out. I mean, let's remember how change happens. You have a worldview that pretty much interprets the world to you, and then you have an experience for which that worldview is insufficient to explain. And then you enter into this period of confusion and sometimes chaos, and you come out on the other side, either denying that that experience happened or was important, or you come out with a revised worldview. And we're living right now in that confused, chaotic time. But to take someone who is absolutely certain that God finds gay people disgusting, if they move from that certainty to confusion, that is a huge step forward, right? You know, I spoke to the gay Presbyterian group at their national convention and congratulating them on confusing their denomination. It didn't quite get reported like I meant it. But yeah, I think that's where we are, and we are not well served by name calling, polarization, demonizing. I mean, gay people ought to know more than anybody the effects of demonizing, and it's no prettier when we do it to other people than when they do it to us. So thank you for that. I got a couple of questions here.
Good afternoon, Bishop. In our polarized society, we have the elite, the intellectual, and then we have the disenfranchised poor people. Among educated people like yourself, you know, once you are in charge of who you are, you know what I mean. You know what a human being is. My question in regard of the very small disenfranchised segment among the LGBT community, which is the poor. Gay men. Practically, you mentioned in your discussion, you mentioned that 40% of kids in the street are actually
LGBT.
LGBT. If you look through it, you realize that those people in the street, they're held in single sex group homes and stuff like that. So naturally, for those young people or young men, they naturally reciprocate. Just in jail, delinquent young men, they go to jail as early as 18 and 19.
Sure.
Sometimes they being taken advantage of by someone over there, and you just turn them into their own gay. So specifically, my question about those young men who become sexually incontinent, and the conventional wisdom for them, if rape is inevitable, you might as well enjoy it. So they practically become sexually incontinent because they were practically received anal stimulation throughout their growing adulthood life, so mm-hmm. they can only achieve orgasms through anal stimulation. It's not because their choice, it's because this is the only option they were offered.
So a couple of things that you bring up there, let me respond to. One is, let's all be clear that violence of a sexual nature is violence. It's about power. It's not about sexuality, right? So nobody is arguing for any kind of non-consensual sexual activity, and it would be even certainly wrong to call it intimacy. It's just a violent act. But what I would say to you is that, you know, the evidence is pretty overwhelming that one's sexual orientation is determined by age 3. It's still there's still some question about how much of that is genetic, how much of that is environmental, but all of the reputable science, subject to peer review, agrees that one's sexual orientation is set by the age of 3 long before it could ever be anyone's choice. Now, are there some serious disturbances that happen to people because they are subjected to some kind of violent trauma? I'm absolutely. But I think that is a completely separate topic from the issue of orientation or choice or whatever. So I would say that some of those people are probably suffering from PTSD or in fact, I would just argue with the notion that that somebody gets turned gay because of an experience like that.
It's a bisexual community.
What's that?
It's a bisexual community.
Yeah? What about them?
They flip the switch, now he's having sex with a woman. Now he flips the switch, now he's having sex
well,
with a man.
Well, I don't know about your body, but mine doesn't have a switch.
But I'm
taking you seriously. Hold on. Let me answer you.
LGBT.
Let me.
There's a segment in your community.
Yeah. Right, so let me try to answer you,
yes.
Okay? Yeah, right. So bisexual people are people who find themselves attracted to a specific individual. And it turns out that that person may be male or female. Some people will ask me, am I bisexual? Because I was married for 14 years and have 2 daughters. I would say no, because if something happens to my husband, when I go out looking for another relationship, I'm only going to be looking at men. A bisexual person, when they want a relationship, go in search of people and are able to respond to that person physically as well as emotionally. Whether the person happens to be male or female. The reason we don't know a lot about bisexuals is that if they're in a relationship with someone who is of the same gender, then they are treated as gay. And if they're in a relationship with someone who is the opposite gender, nobody seems to notice because they look straight. And we have not had the numbers of bisexual people coming forward and telling us their stories so we get to know them better the way we have had gay and lesbian people coming forward. The same is true of the transgender community. It is so horrifically dangerous to come out as transgender. The murder rate for transgender people is simply horrific. And until we make the world a safer place, we're not going to get those stories to help us understand that more. So So that's my response. Bisexual people are a reality. I know some of them. I'll even tell you, my own daughter, who was married for a number of years, had our two grandchildren. Her husband became abusive, and she divorced. And a year and a half ago, I think it was, at Thanksgiving, she called. She seemed really happy, excited, and everything. She said, "Daddy, I've fallen in love." And I said, "Well, sweetheart, that's wonderful." She says, "With a woman." And I said, "Get out. Come on." And she said, "I know." She said, "Isn't it weird?" She said, I never thought about it, never fantasized about it. But I met Penny, and I just was head over heels. And she even called up her sister and said, "You know, I really, really like this woman." She said, "But I don't know if I could do the sex part of this, you know?" And she called back a couple of weeks later and said, "Okay, check." not a problem. So I think, and she would be someone, I've actually not pushed her about what label she would put on herself, but I think that was an instance where she fell in love with an individual. And that person happened to be of the same gender as she. And I think that's possible for some people, and not anything the rest of us are interested in. And so what? Why should it matter? By the way, I have never gone down this route of that so many, even gay organizations and people arguing with this, is that it's not a choice. So what if it is a choice? What difference should that make? It's the quality of the relationships that we care about, right? And by the way, just let you know, I don't think it's a choice, but if it were, what difference would that make? If you want to have a loving, kind, generous, giving, selfless relationship with someone, you go, girl, right? So I think the choice thing is way too heavily relied upon, and we best watch out what we pray for with that. Right there. How are you?
Hi, good to see you again.
Good to see you.
I'm John Richardson. I am a gay man and a priest, and so like you, I have this kind of rare joy and sometimes challenge of being between communities, in both communities.
Yeah, one foot in both. It's kind of fun.
Yeah, it can be. But in my advocacy work for marriage equality, one of the more disconcerting forms of pushback that I've experienced from time to time has been from gay and lesbian people, saying that marriage is something that straight people do, that we that we're putting our work in the wrong place. Mm-hmm. I'm curious what your response to that would be.
Yeah, so I think I alluded to it earlier about this other conversation that we have to have. Most of the time, LGBT people, along with a lot of feminist men and women, would argue that the institution of marriage is so patriarchal, so rooted in the inequality of the sexes, that you'd have to be your head examined. You have to have your head examined to want to go into it. I just think that's a separate conversation. Interestingly, in the Episcopal Church now, at our last general convention last summer, we authorized the use of a new liturgy, and one of the one of the things that bishops in particular said against it was that, what if all the straight couples want to use it too? Because it was very egalitarian. I mean, this is one of the gifts that I think gay and lesbian couples can bring to us. As I always like to say, when two gay men or two lesbians dance, you actually have to decide who leads. You know, the culture will decide for you if you're a straight couple, but if you're a gay couple, you actually have to decide who leads. And so one of the things that we bring to the institution of marriage is at least the egalitarian nature of there not being a disparity in between the genders. And it's just built into and people try to force us into this all the time. I mean, often when I introduce Mark as my husband, somebody will say, "So does that make you the wife?" I mean, it's sort of like we've got these categories, and we got to stuff people into those boxes in order to make sense of it, and it's hard for them to deal with. Actually, no, we're each other's husband. And this is not just an American thing. So Tom Shaw, the bishop of Massachusetts, was deep in the bush in Kenya at a little seminary. I mean, you know, just a thatch roof and so on and so forth. There are about 12 students studying for the ministry there. They're sitting around one night, and all of a sudden everybody becomes really animated. And Tom asked the translator, "What are they talking about?" And he said, "They're talking about Gene Robinson." This is deep in the bush in Africa, okay? And so he said, "Well, tell them I know Gene Robinson." "Oh, my God," they were, "really?" And he said, "Yeah, you know, I've been in their home for dinner and everything. Do you know what they wanted to know? Who cooks? How could two men eat? Because if you don't have a woman to gather the wood and the water and cook, you know, the two gay men would starve to death." Right? So there's so much of this that is rooted in the disparity between genders, and it goes back for a very long time. Actually, the reason I think this is such a controversial issue, and I think it started with the African-American civil rights movement in the 60s, it continued with women in the 70s, now with LGBT people, is this is the very, very beginning of the end of patriarchy. And patriarchy has served men, very well for a very long time. And straight, white, educated Western men have made most of the decisions for most of the world for a very long time. And so is there any wonder that there is resistance to changing it? But people of color, women, disabled people, gay people want a place at the table. And that jig about straight white Western men making all the decisions, that jig is up. Right? Now, it's going to take us a long time to get there, but I think that's why this has such power, because it's changing something pretty darn fundamental to our way of being in the world. Okay, one more question, right there.
I wanted to ask you about kids. About kids, mm-hmm. Because it seems to me that the prevailing legal argument these days is that marriage should be tied to biological procreation. It's, mm-hmm. You know, the ick factor is no longer an acceptable argument against gay marriage anymore.
Right.
And I wonder, you know, if you could give us some guidance as to how to talk to people about that issue.
Great. You'll notice that these arguments do change, right? You'll notice that conservatives now say, well, it's okay to be gay as long as you don't act on it, right? First of all, I don't believe them, that they think it's okay to be gay, because the rest of their behavior doesn't indicate that they think that. But it's a way of sounding a little more sympathetic. So the ick factor thing doesn't work anymore, so let's see, what can we go to now? So I do think not just marriage, but society's stake in marriage is for stable environments for the raising of children. There are 2.5 million children being raised by gay parents right now, and there are 6 million people who, at one point in their life, although they may not still be a child in a home, who were raised by one or more gay parents. So, first of all, it's already happening. And it seems to me that there's and let me also say that even theology and religious institutions have gotten away from procreation being the primary purpose of marriage. After all, we allow people who are infertile and incapable of having children, we allow them to get married. We allow two 80-year-olds to get married who have not much chance of getting pregnant. And so that belies, you know, that argument a bit. And I think it is not a big shift to make from saying that marriage is about creating stable families that are supported by the government. I mean, that's why you get those tax breaks, right? That's why we have all those protections. Frankly, it's why we have divorce. This is something that the gay community gets out of gay marriage, is divorce. Because before gay marriage, two men, two women lived together for however long they want and then split up. There's nobody to make them be nice to each other or fair, right? And what divorce, sometimes not well, but it, the divorce laws are about fair treatment of the other person whom you don't like much right now, right? It's sort of forcing you to love your neighbor as yourself even when you're not feeling like it. And, of course, that has to do with child custody. So you have these horror stories of two lesbians, two gay men, particularly for lesbians, where one of them might actually be the biological mother. And without the protection of the courts, the non-biological mother, it can be completely shut out of that child's life. So it seems to me a small shift to move from the purpose of marriage is procreation. And I think it's related to the fact that we say that intimate sexual activity is only appropriate within marriage. Well, I mean, I haven't married anybody in the last 30 years who has not been living together for a good while. And we don't make them repent. And we don't, you know, castigate them for that. We just work with it, right? To move from marriage as the only appropriate setting for sexual activity to saying it is what is in the child's best interest. And gay marriage ensures that families headed by two gay men or two lesbians also participates in that kind of nurturing environment for children. So in our wedding service now in the Episcopal Church, procreation is mentioned as the third of three purposes of marriage. So that has changed over time. It's changed because of the science, you know. You don't have to be a man and a woman having physical intercourse in order to have children. Not only is there adoption, but there's in vitro fertilization and all kinds of other ways of having children. And frankly, gay men and lesbians have been incredibly generous in adopting the most difficult to adopt children, multiply handicapped, that nobody else will touch. And so the other thing about the children of gay or lesbian couples, every one of them is wanted. Do you know that half of the pregnancies in America are unintended? Half. Some of those kids are going to grow up in an environment that actually doesn't want them. But every kid adopted or conceived by a gay or lesbian couple, that couple has spent tons of money, spent enormous time, and involves incredible intentionality, or else it wouldn't happen. So generally speaking, you can say that kids in a gay family run a very good chance of being wanted, intended, beloved. Which is not to say it doesn't happen also in other families, but I'm just saying. Does that help a little bit? Yeah. Well, thank you all so much. I think we're going to be selling books upstairs. I'm going to be signing and stuff. But thank you all for coming. Great to see you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.